Welcome back to Primetime News and a special welcome to folks on OneSpotMedia.com. The island is now on high alert as the health ministry officially declared a dengue outbreak in the country. It comes after the island recorded 565 suspected and presumed cases as of Friday, September 22. As we hear in this report, children under 14 years are the most at risk.
In announcing the dengue outbreak on Saturday, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Jacqueline Bisesa McKenzie said the dengue type 2 strain is the most prevalent strain at this time. And the last time dengue type 2 was common in the country was in 2010, which spells trouble for children under 14. The health ministry said it became necessary to declare an outbreak because Jamaica surpassed the dengue epidemic threshold for July and August and is on the same path for September. As of September 22, 2023, the country recorded 565 suspected presumed cases of dengue, and of that number, 78 cases have been confirmed, with the majority being recorded in Kingston and St. Andrew, St. Catherine, and St. Thomas. While we were told there are no confirmed deaths, the ministry pointed to 6 deaths under investigation. Dr. Tufton further indicated that the ministry anticipates that the outbreak could continue into 2024, and so the ministry will be providing weekly updates to keep the public informed. Kalisha Williams, TVJ News.
So welcome everybody to another episode of the Lest We Forget podcast, historical podcast by Tenement Yard Media. I'm your host, Davey. And on this episode, it's going to be a special episode. You understand? Firstly, it's our first episode about Barbados history. Like, it took us a while to get there, but we're finally talking about Bajan history. You understand? So, wonderful time we'll be talking about. Secondly, this is our first episode about Caribbean environmental history. So, even more vibes. You see? And we're going to talk about mosquitoes. And how the mosquito problem that the Caribbean have is like colonialism is to be blamed for that as well. Being blamed for a lot of things, but slavery and colonialism get some of the blame. And because we're going to talk about slavery and colonialism, just a bit of content warning for persons. And also a bit of warning for a special group of West Indians. You get me, I'm trying to say, because in recent years, you understand, anything that's around slavery, colonialism, there's a special group of people, I'm going to call them special for a reason, who come up with this thing about how talking about this and teaching slavery breeds victim mentality in West Indian students. You may ask them, I'm going to calm down. You understand, Bill? You understand? This is not, no. You understand? Like, every time somebody talk about slavery, when they start pour up like Broly, like, Mr. and Mrs. Super Saiyans, calm down. Calm down. Understand? Have sense, okay? Calm down. You understand? Make common sense flow through your bloodstream and reach your brain. Understand? This is not it. Cool? Nice. All right. Now, another thing I want to say is that usually when we have episodes, we usually have a written version, specifically for persons who have hearing disability or persons who just don't like podcasts but still want to consume the content in a written format. We shall have it on our website. The written version for this episode will not be on your website. The link gone there, but you're going to take it to another person's website. Warning, it is not an illegal website we are sending it to. It's going to be linked to Island City Lab website. By the time you hear this, them website launch and it live. And Island City Lab, for persons who are not aware, is a Jamaica-based collective that does a lot of educational and conversations around urban planning, environmental policy, architectural engineering and design. Like, a lot of their stuff deals with, you know, all of those studies specifically to the Caribbean, specifically island states. So we're gonna link our thing over there, you know, to them. They are going to have it over there. And while you're over there, check out their other, you know, their other work. Like, they do some amazing work. It's one of the most exciting initiatives I've seen, you know, in Jamaica over the years. They're absolutely amazing. So big up Doreen, big up Jordan. Like, Bernardo is just crazy. Absolutely crazy. Well, it's more for sure. I wrote this episode late 2021, and it's 2023, you know, and I'm staying at my friend's house, and I'm revising it for recording, just to keep it up to date and keep it fresh by the time you hear this. And his cat, Da Vinci, is keeping me company, and this is like 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. So Da Vinci the cat, you understand? But this is my gonna show to you, you understand? Great companion. Big up yourself, sir. You understand? Hope you had a bad piece of sleep. You see me, I try to say. So shout out yourself. Big up yourself. But yeah, with that being said, I feel like I got through all of the things there. Yeah, with that being said, you understand, we are gonna talk about how colonialism is to be blamed for the mosquito problem we're having in the Caribbean. And it's really a crisis, to be honest, because you have so many countries in 2023 talking about, you know, uptaking dengue cases, you know, nationwide. So we're going to talk about how colonialism is to be blamed for that, get some of the blame for that, and also some other ecological transformation that came out of colonial institutions, which, you know, the Caribbean is still dealing with today. So, with that being said, you understand? Let us begin. All right, so before the 1490s, you understand, before, you know, the Europeans came, the indigenous people of the Caribbean, the Kalinagos, the Tainos, and a plethora of others whose name I really can't pronounce, were noted for their relationship with the natural environment. To them, the land was a, and I'm going to quote here, the land was a breathing being on which we move and have our being. As such, they took great care to preserve it and treat it with the utmost respect, as repercussions had dire consequences if you never do that. And you even see a lot of environmental scholars, you know, moving towards indigenous environmental policy because them things didn't make sense. You understand? So across the region, environmental consciousness, even before it was given a name, it was practiced. And that's something that indigenous community in the Caribbean and even worldwide still uphold today. But like all of the region problems, every single one, the environmental awareness went completely left when in October 1492, Christopher Columbus and company, they docked on the shores of the islands of the Bahamas. And in the decade, you understand, of colonial exploration of Christopher Columbus and company, other Caribbean countries became occupied by European colonizers. So we're not going to go through the whole Christopher Columbus and island exploration and da-da-da-da. But when they came here, slavery, as well as disease brought by the Europeans to the region, orchestrated a near genocide of indigenous population across the Caribbean. So needing labor, colonizers of the region decided to follow in the footsteps of Portugal. And Portugal, it's a bit of, you know, history here, sidetrack. Portugal was the first nation to begin the enslavement of Africans for colonial capitalism. From as early as 1444, the Portuguese arrived on the shores of Senegal with the intention to capture black people. Soon after, they began a network that kick-started the Atlantic slave trade. In fact, by the 1600s, their dominance was so vast that other nations would engage with wars with Portugal for their access to enslaved Africans. You understand? And when the English, Dutch, and French would capture Portuguese ships during maritime wars, they often found enslaved Africans and sent them to work in their own colonies. So all of this are kick-started from Portugal. Like, I know, I'm not going to say specifically to the Caribbean, you know, a lot of conversations around Portugal is very much like, you know, I didn't bring up in slavery, but, you know, in South America, specifically Brazil, where most enslaved Africans went, Portugal, man. Portugal legacy stand up tall. So by 1642, however, Portugal and England signed a treaty opening Portugal's slave operation on the African coast to English persons involved in the slave trade. Immediately, English slave ships started showing up in the region. And on these slave ships were not only thousands of enslaved Africans, but a few mosquito did upon the ship them as well. Because if I want thing, mosquito and rat are going to find themselves upon anything we are travel. Cool? All right. Now, the mosquitoes that flew off the ships was known as A. aegyptis. And for this, I'm just going to call them AA because I practice to pronounce it, but sometimes my brain shatters. So, A. aegyptis, and unlike other species, they prefer to breed in water vessels than swamps or puddles. So, these are them settle upon still water. Anyway, still water there, and them, these specifically mosquitoes breed. And as such, wells, barrels, buckets, and pots were perfect habitats for them. It is why they survive on slave ships, which were filled with barrels of water. Their eggs can survive for several weeks in dry conditions if needed. And once the containers are filled with water, the eggs hatch shortly after. And this is why the Caribbean was the ideal climate for these mosquitoes to strive. You get me, Travis? So like, we'll have the weather, plus the bag of ship that may come with a bag of water upon it, you understand? Perfect condition. And once the rainy season arrived after both of drought conditions, the mosquitoes came after. We know this. We see the ads them. Cool. Now, furthermore, these mosquitoes use sight and chemical sensors to source blood. These sensors work better in humid, warm air, where the mosquitoes are attracted to ammonia and lactic acid found in human sweat. Understand? Warm, humid air. I don't care about it. I give a job. It is why men are more bitten by children and women, as men are more likely to sweat more. Now, A. aegyptis like sweet juices, and as such, the rise of sugar plantations led to sugar juices becoming easier to find, which prolong mosquito lives and give them more energy to fly from place to place. When you see the moths, all right. And in a region of slave labor to create sugar, all of these conditions was just the perfect place for this specific breed of mosquito for just kick off. But one island in particular was just too perfect. It was just too damn perfect. You understand? And that was Barbados. Now, in the late 1620s, during the period of sugarcane replacing tobacco as the region's dominant crop, so it was like we still a plant tobacco, but sugar did not take it time to come. You get me what I'm trying to say? Barbados was the first island where sugarcane cultivation took off. So in 1630, the island had a population of 1,400 persons. And by 1642, it was 40,000. Not only did the population growth occur as a result of sugar industry, ecological change also followed. Like a couple ecological change followed. Unlike the other Caribbean island, Barbados only had a few streams and rivers above ground. A large portion of their fresh water is sourced underground. And for persons in, you know, the political science space, even environmental space as well, you know about Barbados' current issue with water and sourcing water from underground, right? And so to counteract the lack of fresh water, European colonizers built watering holes and water tunnels across the island to catch rainwater. So cisterns, rain barrels, pots and pans were also, you know, brought in and built to support the growing population of enslaved black communities and white slave owners. But even more transformation happened because in the 1620s, Barbados was largely uninhabited and densely forested. As Sir Henry Colt wrote in 1631, and this is what he said, just reading some from some of them later.
The whole island is so full of wooden trees, as I could not find any place where to train 40 musketeers.
But as sugarcane became even more prominent, the forest was cleared for more plantations to be built as well as to provide fuel. One person noted in 1671 what was occurring in Barbados because of this.
At the Barbados, all the trees are destroyed, so that wanting wood to boil their sugar, they're forced to send for coals from England.
Now, with trees being removed, weeds multiply all over the island. You get me a job, so like, you know, the gardening people, you get me a job, so. Invasive species like rats and the like became even more abundant while native birds disappeared. Soil erosion became a problem which caused gullies to grow in numbers. If you don't have nothing to protect the topsoil, you get me what I'm trying to say? You're going to have soil erosion due to wind taking place, due to surface runoff taking place, like all of that taking place. And soil erosion just became a huge problem. And then you have a lot of these, like, you know, gullies just start make and a whole heap make. And as one environmental historian, John Robert McNeil, states,
one downpour in November 1668 opened a gully in the churchyard of Christ Church Parish that carried 1,500 coffins and their contents out to sea.
Yeah, so as gullies form, silt carried to the coastline creating new marshes. And when you have horses having difficulty treading the erosive and steep land, donkeys and even camels were brought in. You understand, because they must say, oh, you know, for them a little tougher, them can deal with it. And I try not to write this too much, like, you know, environmental jargon, just try to put it down as simple as I can, because I know myself. Soil erosion also drove down productivity of the soil. You understand? Because again, topsoil is important to farming. You understand? So when the productivity start go down, they brought even more enslaved black people to work these Bajan sugar plantations. And another episode, there's another episode. By the time you hear this, it should be out. This is the episode around land, the fight for land in Jamaica. The Tories of Jamaica will talk about how the productivity and soil, you know, change up a lot of things when it comes to farming after emancipation. So if you haven't checked that episode, check it out. You understand? But yeah, back to me, I say, now, because I started bringing in, you know, more black people to work the Bajan soil as productivity got driven down, it's just like, if the condition did good then, it did perfect now. You understand? And the mosquitoes took advantage of this. And by 1647, Barbados would themselves learn just how perfect these conditions are. And what happened is that come late 1647, a yellow fever epidemic broke out in Barbados. And this is what one manuscript of the event said.
In the year 1647, there was a great plague in Barbados, which raged violently, especially at St. Michael's or the Indian Bridge. It swept away abundance of people.
All right. And even though a significant number of black enslaved men, because my mom tell you, say, men are more, you know, they're more, forget, bitten by mosquitoes than women and children, many of them fell victim on the plantation. Many of them get sick and stuff from yellow fever, but a large portion of the victims come out of this 1647 yellow fever epidemic were European colonizers. And in the victims that survived the illness, they experienced high fever, muscle pains, headaches, nausea, and dizziness. The symptoms usually last 3 to 4 days. And in some cases, the persons have jaundice and internal hemorrhage. Now, the presence of jaundice gave rise to the virus name. That's why it's called yellow fever. But in patients who eventually died from the disease, what you'd have is that after jaundice, them start ooze blood through them nose and ears, them go through delusion, delirium, and then start vomit this black, I'm gonna say coffee colored vomit. Some people say coffee, some people say black. I'm gonna be very honest, coffee look black to me, so it is what it is. And this, even though it was called yellow fever, to the Spanish, they had a special word for the virus. They call it black vomit. You understand? And then after the vomiting, coma and death usually follows. Then another ecological change that propelled yellow fever was the rapid migration of monkeys to the Caribbean. Now, I'm soon getting to all of this. I'm going to talk about the monkeys. That's going to come. Me, David, I'm going to talk about the monkeys. But monkeys arrived to the region via slave ships between 1640 to 1690, specifically the green monkeys, the vervet monkeys. They initially found homes in the woodland of the countries where the only predators were dogs and humans. But as these forestry areas were cleared for sugar plantation, the monkeys eventually found their way to the plantation for home and food. This brought them in close proximity to humans, where the monkeys were also host of the yellow fever virus. It also never helped that a lot of European colonizers were keeping the monkeys as pets. You understand? And that brought them even to more close proximity to humans for the virus to be transformed. But we'll soon get into the monkey. We'll give the monkey them special time for shine. Later in the episode, we're going to talk about them. No. As the epidemic took over Barbados and thousands of white persons died, black people were brought in to replace them. And the mosquito disease outbreak also made the island less attractive to British immigrants. And so by the 1660s, Barbados was the first slave society in the British West Indies. And I don't really want to go too much into that, you understand, because there's a whole other episode about Barbados being the first slave society. But for persons who want a quick pickup, Sir Hilary Beckles, one of the region's most decorated historian, he has a book around Barbados being the first slave society. I really believe it's called Barbados, the First Slave Society. you guys can just go check that out. I think it's in Tenement Yamida Library. I believe it's in our library, which I'm not sure. But yeah, that's a good introduction of what that first slave society meant. You understand? So you can go check that. Now, out of them being the first slave society in the British West Indies, the slave code was established in Barbados and then was adapted to other countries, Jamaica, Trinidad, a plethora of Caribbean countries, and even found its way to the U.S. states of South Carolina and Virginia. You understand? So, all will link up. You understand? All in the diaspora link up. You understand? Out of that slave code. And like the slave code, mosquitoes and yellow fever spread from Barbados to other areas. So it's like as slavery spread and as slavery become this very structured institution, mosquitoes just take up on a ride alongside with it. You get me I try to say? Yeah, man. So them go. And so as more Africans were brought into work the plantation, more mosquitoes crossed the ocean to the Caribbean. And it just became this perfect cycle. So perfect that from the 1650s to the 1900s, mosquitoes, specifically yellow fever, wrecked the region completely. As one person noted in a diary entry in the 1800s, after a period of rainfall,
such an abundance of mosquitoes resulted that all the walls of the houses appeared black.
Then as mosquitoes started to wreck the region, you know, have the region in a chokehold, in 1881, the Cuban physician Carlos J. Finley corrected theorized that yellow fever was being transmitted by mosquitoes. Now, I just want to say this for the history people. Now, Carlos J. Finley, his contribution to curbing yellow fever is largely uncelebrated outside of the Caribbean. And even in some places in the Caribbean, because the discovery of mosquitoes and yellow fever is largely attributed to the U.S. military. Another them discovered. Them discovered after the monster MC, you understand? The U.S. military came out with this theory in the 1900s, you understand? When they set up the Yellow Fever Commission, you understand? That stated that the disease was transmitted via mosquito bite. But Carlos Finley, you understand? Him say, I say all of this from 1881. People never did hear him, but that's it. You understand? So the discovery laid at his feet. You understand? The U.S. military never take credit for that one. Yeah. Now, Cuba, who would be under U.S. military occupation soon after, would see one of the first national policies to curb the breeding of mosquitoes. As such, the commission began to set up mosquito control programs all over the island. This includes improving sanitation, widespread use of insecticides, reduction in the standing water areas that allow for mosquito breeding. Come on, I'm telling you, them specific mosquito here. They know the swamp. You understand? Feed them thing, still water. Anyway, you store water, they say them there. You understand? And they also start publishing facts about mosquitoes in local newspapers. So by March 1901, martial law was implemented in the country to further curb the cases. Persons were classified as either non-immune because they had no medical history of yellow fever, or immune because they had a past history of yellow fever. And then soon after all of these programs were implemented, the number of cases in Cuba fell drastically. Now, in nearby Panama, however, the turn of the century saw mosquitoes a deal with them. You understand it? A deal with them. And in the 1880s, a major outbreak of yellow fever prevented the French from building the canal. That's one of the reasons why they abandoned the project. Because what they saw was over 22,000 workers died during that period, many of them from malaria and yellow fever. A great number of these deaths were West Indians who fell victim to this racist belief that West Indians were immune from yellow fever vibes. So just one of those medical history that discriminate, you know, where discrimination in health practice and black people are victims of that. You understand? And so many people died. So many people. Again, the numbers are approximately 22,000, but definitely more than that. But when the U.S. took over the project in 1904, yellow fever and no malaria were a concern. By 1906, it was reported that roughly 85% of canal workers were hospitalized with either of these two diseases. So to control the epidemic, this brother named Dr. William Gorgias, who worked on Cuba's epidemic prior, received funding from the U.S. to continue controlling efforts in Cuba. In the summer of 1905, So in the summer of 1905, private homes began to be sprayed with insecticide and oil was placed on standing water to prevent mosquito breeding. And those practices still exist today. So by October in 1905, cases were cut in half and almost a year later, the epidemic was over in Panama. However, by the 1940s, a vaccine for yellow fever was developed, where today yellow fever is more or less under control. But this is the problem. This is just yellow fever. This is just yellow fever. This is just yellow fever. Understand? Mosquitoes are just these very interesting creatures, because if I want thing with them, they are going to adapt and evolve and just develop these new strain of viruses. You get me? According to the National Institute of Health, between 2013 and 2019, 186,050 cases of dengue, 911,842 cases of chikungunya, and 143,127 cases of Zika were reported in the Caribbean. And this is just the Caribbean. I'm sure Brazil have got you it. Feel them numbers high because of Brazil. Like every year, Brazil have a flare-up of a mosquito-borne disease. And this is 2013 to 2019. So if you add in a couple more figures, given this year, a year where the effects of climate change were blatantly witnessed and experienced, yeah, where a lot of, as I said before, a lot of these countries have announced a dengue outbreak, I'm sure the numbers crazy right now. Crazy are being added to this. And I'm going to give you an example. By early November, you know, when this episode I get recorded, Jamaica health authorities announced that 3,147 suspected, presumed, and confirmed cases were on the island. This is 2023, bro. 2023. It's something I talk about people that might say slavery and colonialism, history, breed victim mentality in the Caribbean. This is why I'm still quiet. You understand? Still, the mosquito situation is just one of the few issues that came out of the ecological changes due to colonialism in the region. In the wake of climate change effects in the region, many countries have turned to using tree planting as a mitigation policy. But tree planting can do so much more when you have widespread deforestation of the region. Deforestation which colonialism played a major, major role. And so, one of the best examples, Montserrat. The island was a wild forested area in 1631. By 1676, a third of the forested area was cleared for sugar production. By the 1770s, the island was almost devoid of woodlands. In recent years, the country has implemented a yearly national tree planting initiative. And as the then plant nursery and agroforestry supervisor, Gervain Greenaway, yo, this is a name. If I'm in a disposition. Gervain Greenaway, this is what he said in 2011.
There are not much fruit trees around, so we are trying to get as much trees back into the environment. We are doing our part to cut down on greenhouse gases and just beautify the whole of Montserrat.
But Montserrat is just one example of a country who have faced these severe situations. By 1791, the environmental effects of colonialism were so severe in the Eastern Caribbean that Alexander Anderson, a supervisor at St. Vincent Botanical Gardens, wrote to this brother named Sir George Younge, that's Younge, and this is what he said.
It is a matter of astonishment to see the inconsideration or rather the stupidity of West Indian planters in extinguishing many useful woods that spontaneously grow on all these islands except in the St. Vincent and Dominica. Hardly the vantage of a tree is to be seen of any sort where the planter's axe could get at. Barbados, Antigua, and St. Kitts are almost rendered unfit for cultivation by the destruction of wood.
And this clearing of forestry was not only for a sugar plantation. I just want to get that right. Because while reading Mosquito Empire's Ecology and War in the Greater Caribbean, 1620 to 1914, the author of that book, J.R. McNeill, he stated something of interest that is in the book. And this is what he said.
They tried to recreate the open vistas of the British Isle for aesthetic reasons. They needed room for their livestock to roam.
So yeah, in simple term, them didn't want aesthetic, so they just had clearer trees. They just had clearer trees, so aesthetic. You understand, like, vibes. And then on larger countries like Jamaica and Cuba, where you had a very larger maroon population who seek freedom in the mountain forestry of these countries, slave owners seek retribution by cutting and burning down these forested areas. You get me? So, bugger problems. And the ecological effects went beyond the land, you understand, because indigenous animals also felt the effects of colonialism. As you know, I'm gonna give you an example that still to this day cut me to my core. No, the green turtle was once abundant in the Caribbean. But soon after the English came to the region, they started to feed enslaved Africans salted turtle meat as it was affordable and easy to catch. In fact, in Jamaica specifically, between 1700 to 1730, most of the meat eaten in Jamaica was turtle meat. They made a deal with turtle meat, you understand? And soon after, the meat was seen as a delicacy in England, where it was touted for its aphrodisiac qualities. By the 1800s, the green turtle population of the region decreased immensely. In 2011, a zoologist at the University of West Indies, Mona, Dr. Brian Wilson, this is what he stated specifically about where Jamaica is on the turtles.
As turtles were once abundant in Jamaican waters, and the island's beaches hosted huge nesting populations of the spectacular and prehistoric creatures. But centuries of overexploitation, mostly during the 1600s to 1800s, decimated regional populations. Recent estimates suggest that Caribbean stocks of green and hawksbill sea turtles, formerly the most abundant species, have been reduced by 99.7%. Today, both species are ecologically and functionally extinct.
Yeah, and this is, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, Jamaica turtles are basically extinct, and even in other Caribbean countries. But you do have a lot of environmental orgs who are doing a lot of work of like reintroducing turtles along the shores of Jamaica. I know there's a group in Urakabesa who does work around that, and they usually invite like persons to like see what they're doing and stuff like that and take part. And we can't talk about animals and slavery and talk about monkeys. You understand? We have to talk about monkeys. You understand? So we did mention up above how the monkeys got introduced to the Caribbean. Well, you see, after them become to the Caribbean, right? In a few years, like around the 1680s, the green monkeys, the vervet monkeys, became notorious pests in the Caribbean, specifically in two countries, Barbados and St. Kitts and Nevis. And throughout the years, the monkey situations has gotten so bad in St. Kitts and Nevis that in recent years, the nation had to create a monkey task force to curb the issue. Now, I just want to say, I found out about the monkey situation in St. Kitts and Nevis in 2020. And I decided at the time when I had a Twitter account, not on social media anymore, so that whole thread is not there anymore. But I did tweet out about the monkey situation in St. Kitts and Nevis. And, you know, got a bit of interest around the monkeys. And for persons who have no idea around the monkey task force and the monkey situation in St. Kitts and Nevis, what is happening in that country is that their monkey population has just blossom. You understand? It has gotten wild. And yes, it has become like a I'm not gonna say a major, but it's become a tourist attraction in recent years because these monkeys have developed a reputation for being drunk, like the drunk monkeys of St. Kitts and Nevis. Them start get high by sugar bone, you know, plantation era, and then just make them weird grown. But in recent years, when their population, you know, start to get crazy, these monkeys start raiding farms, vandalizing properties, harassing livestock. And listen, yeah, what part of them start stoning you? There's those stories them start stoning people when they're up on the road. You understand? And then in December 2020, St. Kitts and Nevis, they don't have enough. They can't deal with it. This is crazy. Like, COVID just made the situation worse. And so the government decided that what they're going to do, they announced this proposed shooting monkey exercise in Newton Ground to Belmont Mountain to curb the area's monkey population. So them just got full, you know, Planet of the Apes. I'm just going to start shooting monkey them. You understand? It is what it is. And in a press release, the government stated, this is what the government said, on December 3rd, 2020.
All farmers in these areas are asked, if they are not attending the monkey control meeting, they're also asked to stay away from their farms during this period.
But what happened was, the shooting never successful. It wasn't a successful thing. Most recently, in 2021, you know, the St. Kitts and Nevis Agriculture Authorities, they started selling monkey meat to make dog food as an effort to control the monkey population. You understand? So that was one of the next things they start to do. Animal feed. But they did state that they won't stop people from buying it for personal use. Like in some parts of St. Kitts and Nevis, this is not something that's widely done. In some parts, okay, let me just say that specifically, monkey meat is a delicacy. You understand? So then this did not stop nobody, but specifically it's dog food. But vibes. And in the past, they have had other ways of dealing with the monkeys. They have tried even, at some point, the monkeys were exported to the US to serve as test subjects for drug creation. So they have tried a bit of different things. But as I said before, not on social media anymore. So don't see that thread about the whole monkey thing that's being laid out. But I did an interview because, somebody from St. Kitts and Nevis is like, yo, David, do you want to remember what the monkey is? Do you have some meetings I can sit in? Which was fun. That was fun. I was learning a lot. I end up making connection with this ethnoprimatology expert, Dr. Kerry Doerr. She's the national coordinator of St. Kitts and Nevis Invasive Species Project. End up speaking to her. And I recorded that conversation on Checkmate, which is Tenement Yard Media political podcast. So if you want more information about the monkeys, and I'm being super honest with you, it's one of the most interesting conversations I've ever had. Learn a lot. It was a lot. You can go ahead and check out that. We're going to link it on the page, on this episode's podcast page. But please, go ahead and listen. And the monkeys are also issue in Barbados. And I've seen reports that, you know, monkeys have been spotted in Jamaica and, you know, they're raiding farms and stuff. So it's becoming a region issue and just not at the scale of what St. Kitts and Nevis going through, but it's still there. So can check out that conversation over there. And yet there are so many more ecological issues that we can speak about that have their origins due to colonialism. You understand? When people think about colonialism, they think about slavery, it's just like, oh, you know, people in the field and they might get whipped and stuff. No, it's an institution. It touched every single facet of the region. And it's almost a 400-year institution. You understand? Legally, when it ends, because you still have persons who were under some very creative slavery, post-emancipation, that it still is in the region DNA and in our problems. You understand? And what makes this situation even more prominent now is that as climate change continues to affect the region, you understand, it is important that as persons who live here, persons whose interest lies here and their identity are created in the Caribbean region, will understand how deep the roots of colonialism are intertwined with our current problems. You understand? And that's a word to Dr. Walter Rennie. See? And still, similar to one of the other podcast episodes, which we did, The Salt Plantations of the Caribbean, which, I'm being super honest, one of the best things I've ever written. At the end, you know, we made a note that, you know, we should have called this episode, you know, Salt, Colonialism and its Effects. And this episode, same thing, mosquitoes, colonialism and its effects. You understand? So the next time you spot a mosquito, you get me a travesty. You can't blame climate change, definitely. You know, government neglect, you understand? Poor urban planning, definitely up there. And in some cases, you understand, your fellow countrymen, you understand, as a Jamaican, I will blame Jamaicans for a few things. When it comes to mosquitoes, especially people with stone and runway health officials when they must spray, please stop. Let the people do them job. Please, let the people do them job. But while, you know, there are a lot of blames to be passed around, we have to also blame our colonizers. Some of the blame supposed to be rested in, you understand? So when you don't know, we are bringing up the paper, we have the local presentation them, you understand, for reparations and stuff. Me personally want a special chapter under there for mosquitoes. Environmental reparations specifically. If we build some ward, you understand? Give us some thing, we don't know. You understand? For mosquito cases specifically, something we need to do. You understand? Because it rests on them feet.
And with that, we call an end to today's episode. To view the sources used in this episode and our recommendations to learn more about the topic, visit our website at tenementyardmedia.com. A transcript of this episode will be available 5 days after it has been posted to podcast outlets. And remember, this is a conversation we really want to hear from you. Follow our social media pages at tenementyard_ on both Instagram and Twitter to view additional postings on this episode and updates on other content created by Tenement Yard Media. We're open to conversation about this and other episodes, and really, all happenings around Caribbean history and culture. Just a quick note before we leave, we're over on Patreon at patreon.com/tenementyardmedia if you would like to support the show with a monthly donation of as little as $1. You can also make a donation of your choice at tenementyardmedia.com. Until next time, this has been Lest We Forget, a historical podcast from Tenement Yard Media. Walk good!